I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Welcome to The Connection. Long-distance swimmer Diana Nyad had three messages as she staggered out of the water after completing her 2013 historic swim between Cuba and Key West. Never, ever give up. You are never too old to chase your dreams. Her accomplishment was a team effort. She had first tried this grueling swim in 1978 when she was 28 years old, then twice in 2011 and again in 2012. Each time, the powerful currents and countercurrents, the sharks, and especially the deadly box jellyfish forced her to abandon her quest to be the first person to make the crossing without a shark cage. Nyad made it on her fifth try at the age of 64, swimming 110 miles in just shy of 53 hours. She said that being in her 60s and feeling her mortality was a great motivator. Now in her mid-70s, Diana Nyad says she is living the best decade of her life. She joins us on The Connection to discuss her extraordinary career, her competitive drive, trauma, and the healing power of forgiveness, and the lessons she has learned about aging. Diana Nyad has worked as a journalist and broadcaster, including for NPR. She's written several books, including a memoir titled Find a Way, which was made into the biopic Nyad in 2023 with Annette Bening in the starring role. Well, Diana Nyad, nice to have you with us today on The Connection.
Marty, it's my pleasure, and what an honoring intro that was. Thank you.
Well, you're very welcome. You and I are essentially the same age, so I was thinking about being in our 70s, and I remember being in my 20s and my 30s and my 40s and even in my 50s thinking, oh my God, 70 seems so old. But I also know that you really reject the limitations and even the stereotypes about the aging process. So being 76 years old, do you think of yourself as old?
You know what? I'm not even sure what that definition is. I'm not running from it. You know, we got to get real. You know, one day it's all going to end. And if you pretend you're not that age or your skin isn't sagging or, you know, you don't have the balance you used to have, then, you know, you're kidding yourself. You got to get real. And I think as an athlete, you know, that's what we do with life is we get real of what we can do and what's in front of us. But I'm not sure, of course. I'm a senior, of course, at 76. I'm older. I'm in an older generation. But when you say, do you consider yourself old? You know, that takes a lot of connotations
on it. It does.
Right? It's very different than saying, yes, I'm older now. You know, but you say, oh, I'm old. You know, a woman came up to me, you know, not too recently and said, well, you know, she was just after a speech, she was saying, you know how it is. I'm exactly your age. And, you know, when we're our age, you wake up and you can barely walk. And, you know, you're so creaky that your knees won't bend. And I said, oh, no, speak for yourself. I wake up full of agility and energy, and I don't wake up barely able to walk. So you said it just a minute ago that I'm not a fan of blanket limitations. You know, let's just say healthcare organizations. It's up to them to go get statistics. They have to see how many people they can insure at this age who are going to need this or not going to need this. So probably at 76, if you looked at the profile of most healthcare organizations, they would say, oh, uh-oh, they're tired, they're slow, they fall down every day, they have no energy. So I refuse to put that limitation on myself because it's not real.
Well, maybe a better question is, do you feel more mortal, feeling that the clock is ticking on your life?
You know, in sixth grade, Marty, I was at my little sixth grade graduation with my mother, and all the parents and the teachers and the coaches and the other students were there. And Jimmy, our class speaker, was evidently, because the principal came to me and he knelt down next to me. We're ready for the whole program to start. And he said, Diana, Jimmy is in the bathroom vomiting violently. He can't do it. He's scared to death. He can't get up and speak today. Would you say a few words? My mother was on this side and she pulled me over toward her and she said, what did he just say? You didn't prepare anything. You're going to make a fool of yourself. You're going to make a fool of me in front of all these people. Tell him no. You could have at least had a half hour notice. And so I listened to her and I turned back to him and I said, well, how long were you wanting running? I mean, is this a half hour or is it just a couple of minutes? He said, anything. We don't have a class speaker, anything. And I honestly, Marty, don't remember that little speech I gave, but my mother remembered it all her life. And if you had met her, the first thing she would have told you was, you know what my daughter said at that speech? She got up and said, we are mortal. And you know what? I know it seems a long way away, but if you look at our grandparents and their ages, we probably were 11 now. So let's just say we've been doing our best. Let's give us that. But we only have about 70 years to live. We got to get busy. We got to be doctors. We got to help people. We got to speak foreign languages and travel the world and know other cultures. Come on. Maybe we've been doing our best, but we got to get busy because this thing is going to go over very quickly. So, Marty, I'm nothing special. 8 billion people live on this planet, and every one of them deserve love and dancing and life, and they have many special talents, all of them. But I must say, I was unusual for a child because even in single digits at age 8 and 9, I would think the time is flying by. I don't have much time. Pretty soon I'm going to be 12. Then I'm going to be in college. So I had a feeling about this rapidity of the clock ticking, even though I agree, it seems like it's going faster now. But I always had the morbidity, feeling to me.
I can't imagine even a young Diana Nyad was ever at a loss for words.
Well, oddly, I'll tell you one. It's not to the point of your interview, so you're going to be mad at me taking up time. But when Lily Tomlin's first play came out on Broadway, it was what was it? Intelligent Life in the Universe, something
Yes,
like
exactly.
that. I had just swum around Manhattan, so I had a little bit of fame cachet in Manhattan, and we got front row tickets. My best friend and I were sitting in the front row, and before the show started, her stage manager came over and said, Miss Tomlin would love it if you would come visit her in the dressing room right after the show. And we were just too cool. We looked at our watches and said, well, I mean, that would be fun, but we're awfully busy, But as soon as the play ended, we ran, to get in line. It was a little skinny, smoke-filled hallway. And we got up there, but I was such a fan, such a deep admirer of Lily Tomlin and her brain and her delivery and her comic genius that when she opened the dressing room door, and by the way, my friend was a severe stutterer, so I'm always going to do the talking. And Lily Tomlin opened the door, and I went like this. I stuttered worse than my friends ever stuttered. And she was confused, and the phone rang, and they were partying there. She shut the door, and we never got in. So I was once at a loss for words.
Exactly. Well, I certainly appreciate that story. I wonder though, but as a kind of marathon long distance swimmer that you are, whether where time is so important, right? You're up against the clock, whether that appreciation of time or even the kind of race against time has been a driver in your life.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think if you just take the big sort of macro view. So I'm 76 now, but even when I was 56 or 36 or 16, I thought, what am I doing? How much time is left? Am I going to waste my time doing this and that? Now, as I've gotten older, the appreciation, the gratitude for this beautiful planet, for the blue ocean, for the blue sky, for the dogs in our lives, for the people we love and respect, that has grown deeper. And my sense of the right thing to do with time is to be successful. That has waned a lot. And just to be conscious and be aware of this beautiful life we live. My friend, the one that went to the Lily Tomlin concert with me, play, Candace Hogan. When she first met me in my apartment in New York, she came and found me and she said, Diana, I just went in your bathroom and what are those index cards stretched across the string on a string above the sink. I said, oh, those are German and French and Spanish vocabulary cards because I'm not going to stand there and brush my teeth for 45 seconds and do nothing. Just stand there and do nothing. I'm going to learn those vocabulary words. So that's who I used to be. And I think I still am that filled with a joie de vivre and a want. A desire to live it big every day. But it's not all about what can I achieve and what can I learn. I just want to be awake and conscious of this life that we get to live. That's a turn I've made as I've gotten older.
No, and I appreciate that. I'm also interested because your body has been your life. It's been your strength. It's been how we know who you are because you're in this incredible swimmer. But I wonder whether your relationship with your body, which obviously is older now, and is not the body you have when you were 64 or when you were 28, what that relationship is. And do you see the strength? Do you appreciate how it has changed over time?
You know, I just want to tell you right now, it hasn't changed much.
Good for
Marty,
you.
I get up at dawn every day. I do a kick-ass workout. I play tennis with 30 and 40-year-olds. And I'm not saying I'm not older. My balance is definitely, if I approach a steep set of stairs that has no railing, I stand there for a second like, let's get this together and be really ginger going down. So, you know, I recognize that, especially the balance aspect. But the rest of it, the muscular system, the cardiovascular system, the energy, and I've just been, I don't use the word blessed much because I'm an atheist, but if you could use that in a non-religious term, I've been blessed with a huge energy level, and that hasn't waned at all at this age. So yeah, I'm older, and now maybe you and I speak in 10 years, and you and I are about the same age. I could say, oh, I had no idea what was going to hit me at 81. You know, my memory's going and I'm falling all over the place. But for right now, sitting with you today, I feel as strong and as fit as I have my entire life.
I'm almost reluctant to ask this question, and I'm looking at the clock here, but I was thinking about that you have lived so much of your life in a bathing suit. And I think for a lot of people, especially older people, older men and women, clearly women, just feel uncomfortable to be in a bathing suit feeling like they are half naked. And in about a minute or less, have you ever felt that? Or is the bathing suit or whatever you're wearing kind of a second skin for you?
No, let me go with that phrase I started with, let's get real. So, you know, so I was just in Italy and I went to take a swim in the Mediterranean. And of course, the skin especially, you know, we can keep our muscles fit and keep muscle mass even going if you really work at it. But, you know, I just, and I'm not going to be the type that goes gets a bunch of surgery, but what am I going to care? Am I really going to stand there before I take off my cover up and say, oh, I'm not the beautiful body I used to be, so I'm going to keep myself from the experience of going in the Mediterranean? Women say to me all the time, I'm not going to swim on this vacation, even in a hotel pool, because I'm about 10 pounds overweight. And I said, you would keep yourself from that experience because some stranger at the pool who's not looking at you anyway is going to, you know, have an opinion. No, I'm going. I feel in great shape. I'm going in the pool in the ocean right the way I am.
Well, good for you. And that's Diane Nyad. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Diana Nyad, a long-distance swimmer, the first person to swim from Cuba to Florida without a shark tank. She's also been a journalist, wrote a book a couple of years ago called Find My Way. I know you've talked about this umpteen millions of times, but I have just a couple of questions about this historic swim that you did in 2013, because I think it's really connected to what we've been talking about. You tried in 78 and you didn't make it. You tried again in 2011, two times. You tried in 2012, and then you finally succeeded in 2013 to make this historic, really legacy building swim. What kept bringing you back?
You know, it was a dream. A lot of people have dreamt of Everest all their lives, or dreamt of snowshoeing across Antarctic because of a book they read. Well, for me, I grew up in Southern Florida, right down the road from Miami. When the Cuban Revolution happened, I was 9 years old, and literally overnight, thousands of Cubans became our friends and flooded into our neighborhood. And we would stand on that beach and say, it's right out there. My mother said to me, I was nine, Cuba, you're, and I was already a little competitive swimmer, pool swimmer. She said, it's so close. As a matter of fact, it's so close that you little champion swimmer, you could actually swim there. So that image got into my brain early, and then later it turned out I was a champion open water swimmer in my 20s, held a lot of world records, like around Manhattan Island for both men and women. And that Cuba one, that was the Holy Grail. That was the one that was always, and by the way, all the terrific swimmers who have tried Cuba have never gone back a second time. If they didn't make it, if they got stung by that box jellyfish or those currents turned them around, they never went back. So you got to give our team credit. We learned, we got more intel, we got smarter, we got space imagery from NASA, and we went back over and over. And every time we had more intel, and we had a chance to finally make it across.
Obviously, physically grueling, and I cannot imagine, what it took to be able to prepare for it, then obviously to make this historic swim. But I wonder too, mentally, especially when you're by, there are boats around you, but you are by yourself, you're in the water, you say at mile 50, you've got 60 miles to go. What are you saying to yourself? What are you thinking about? What are you doing in your head?
Yeah, well, first of all, it's not like that. You have no idea. If you're at miles 50, you have no idea if there's 60 miles to go. You might be going that way and that way. So you don't, it's not a measurement of 111 miles exactly across.
Got it.
And we have no idea when we're going to make it or if we're going to make it. So my job, I'm in this area, picture it. I'm in this sort of in the interior of the mind. I'm turning my head 53 times a minute this way. I don't see anything except the boat and Bonnie, my head handler on the boat. I don't hear anything. You're not allowed headphones in this sport. You got to use the discipline of it. So I'm singing songs to myself. I'm counting numbers and I'm just getting through my job. The way I looked at it was if this is going to take 2.5, 3 nonstop days, I'm going to take the nighttime. Just get through the night, wait till the sunrise comes, then make another plan and get through the day and wait till the sun goes down, then make another plan and get to the sunrise again. So those were the increments that I focused on, the day, then the night, then the day, then the night, and hopefully on that third day, which happened, we would get there.
Right. Did you dissociate, you think?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. First of all, you're in this state of, I just describing sensory deprivation. You've got nothing coming in. So, your childhood is wafting across your brain. You're thinking of Stephen Hawking sentences that you read the night before you went out. You're fully hallucinating. Because that sleep deprivation gets added on to the sensory deprivation. So it takes a strong mind. Yes, it takes the body. You get the body ready first, then it's the mind that takes you across. And then it's that team. That was a team of 40 people. It starts with Bonnie, but there were the shark divers taking that off my worry list. There's the navigator taking the very intricate navigation across this Gulf Stream on that boat. There's the medical team. There's the jellyfish team. There's the nutrition team. So it's like a car racer who's alone, but that pit crew is the crew that's going to allow that car to function.
Did you, and I use the word suffer, but I mean that. Did you suffer at all during this historic swim?
Sure. I mean, I think it would be, useless to say you don't.
Yeah.
And you know what? I tell you the truth, Marty, it's a very difficult to sport at the extreme end of it, like I do. And there are swimmers like Sarah Thomas, 4 times consecutive English Channel, extraordinary athlete. We're at the extreme end. And so it's easy when you talk about our accomplishments to fill it with the hardships, and the pain that comes with it, the suffering. But there are moments. To look up at the sky and see a billion stars
Wow.
above you in the middle of the Gulf Stream at night on a summer's night. There are moments where you feel like you're literally traveling over the curvature of the earth with your own 2 arms. So there's some beatific glory to it as well as the suffering. But the suffering, I made a contract. When I decided to do this swim, I said, it doesn't matter what comes, what pain comes my way, what suffering comes my way, I'm gonna have a titanium will that gets me through it. So I never, ever indicated to Bonnie, I want to stop. Help me, help me find my true grit. That we never came to that. I'm gonna stick with it. It doesn't matter what pain happens.
I'm curious about, let's say, in the middle of the night and you're swimming, what does it sound like? What are the sounds that you hear around you?
You know, really, because I tell you, you're in that isolation, all I hear is the slapping of my arm. So I take 53 strokes a minute. That's with the left hand. So you could say I hear 106 slaps per minute. So it's like sploosh, swoosh, swoosh. And that takes you into that sensory deprivation even deeper because you're in this kind of meditative state. So you lose track of who you are, what you're doing, why you're doing it, and that's what Bonnie's for. You know, Bonnie blows that whistle, whether it's a shark or whether it's a feeding time, and I snap out of the reverie and I'm back in.
Speaking of Bonnie, I do want to play a clip from a 2013 documentary. It's called Diana by Wigs Unscripted. And this is Bonnie Stoll and you talking about your relationship. Let's give it a listen.
Diana's an anomaly, and I don't think that I can relate to the way her mind works. Very difficult for me to say, I'm in. Now, that being said, if Diana gets in the water, I'm certainly not going to let her get in without me, you know, because I'm indispensable.
You know, I would say that just day to day, you know, Bonnie's my closest connection. She is the head handler. She's part general and part soulmate. She's in charge of my safety, my well-being, and my athletic being. You know, and we really understand each other. We spend a lot of time together. We're kind of like two golden retrievers who just sort of pal around everywhere together, you know.
I really like that, two golden retrievers, because that's an image I think we can relate to.
Yeah, and that's the truth. And you know, I always feel somewhat sensitive, I have to tell you, Marty, because I have we say an equal best friend. I've known even longer than Bonnie, Candace. And Candace was the only person on my boat all 35 years. She was on the boat in 78 when I didn't even know Bonnie yet. So yeah, Bonnie and I have become this, you know, represent this iconic best friendship, and it is all that. But I want to tell you right here today, that Candace, I'm lucky. You know, people say you're lucky in your lifetime if you have one friend who is all your life going to be loyal to you and you're going to be equals together. You're lucky. Well, I have two. So I'm very lucky that way.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And again, that's Diana Nyad. She's a long distance swimmer, a famed long distance swimmer, and joins us today on The Connection to talk about her life, to talk about aging, as we all are. And we've been talking about her historic swim between Cuba and Key West. I also want to talk about the sexual abuse that you endured from a swimming coach that you had as a teenager. This is something that you have written about, something you have talked about, and I think it's such an important issue because it's hard to know how to talk about it and how to understand what happens to someone who has been the someone who has been victimized, especially by a coach who really believed in you. And you believed in him. I mean, it was such a betrayal of that relationship beyond even the physical and sexual assaults.
Yeah, but you know what, Marty? I think that, you know, first of all, you know, for me, I need to always put, you know, my hardship, when that is the hardship of my life, that one, in perspective. You know, you look at the pictures of Gaza every day. And you know, I've never, you know, suffered anything that dire, of course. Most of us have not. So, you know, all of us, you know, have you ever met a 90-year-old who says, you know, the whole thing, it was just a wonderful trip through life. We all have our hardships and our suffering. And my particular, and to this day, look at me, you getting to know me. We've known each other before. I'm pretty darn confident and happy and together, and I live the biggest life I can, and I'm grateful for every minute of every day. But that sexual abuse still, after years of therapy, after being loved by all kinds of wonderful people, it still has a terrorizing and traumatic effect on my little girl being, who was, as you say, so innocent and so betrayed by this person that she trusted, you know, had on a pedestal up into the heavens. So, you know, I don't think you ever get over it. You know, when somebody says to me, "Oh, you must be over that by now," I said, "You have no idea what you're talking about." Like, people don't get over war. People don't get over trauma. They live with it. They get better. They come to peace with it. But that it was wrong, and I wished my regret. is that I wished I had gone and taken him and picked him up in the air and thrown him against a wall and gone and told my mother and told the school principal. I only wish, it's a huge regret. And then I blamed myself for all of it happening, which is often the victim of sexual abuse's pattern, you know? So it's been decades of working through all that shit, honestly.
Well, and you wrote in the Free Press, this is where I saw this article, a recent article, Ancient Wisdom, how Diana Nyad learned to forgive herself. And you talked about the sort of outside, what the world observed as Diana Nyad and what she was feeling on the inside. Two very different experiences, two very different worlds. And just to underscore what you just said, you wrote, it wasn't until my 50s that I found peace is no longer blaming myself. But then there followed a thunderous berating of myself for wallowing so long in that self-blame in the first place. So, yeah. You know, once you got over the one part of the blame, then you had another part of the blame that you had to deal with.
Yeah, and I'll give you a kind of shallow example, but just the other day, I was bringing in some things from my car to the house, and so I should have taken two or three trips. You know, that would have saved time. But no, I thought, no, I can get it all at once. I'm in a hurry. So I reached in the back seat and got all these bags, some around the fingers and some under the arms. And then I got to get a car key to lock the car and then get in the house. Well, it just was sloppy. And as I was trying to get the key into the door, one of the bags fell. All the groceries, the apples started rolling around on the on the driveway. And I went into a rage. You know, I'm not angry at anybody else. You can't, it doesn't mean that I can't be kind of hard ass if people are behaving poorly or behaving, you know, inefficiently at their job, at the bank or something. But as a general rule, I don't have tremendous anger that's exuding all day. And I was so angry at this happening. But the words that came out were the words that coach used on me in those sexual moments. And they were humiliating words. They were disparaging words. That's what he got off on. Mm-hmm. You know, he was not, oh, you're my little sweet honey. Not that that would have made it right either. That's sexual abuse of a teenager. But in my case, I now have twisted the psychology. And actually, when I'm angry and frustrated, I use his old words from, I mean, Marty, 65 years ago. I use them on myself. And so do I work on this? Yes. And am I better than I used to be? Yes, that event is long in the rear view mirror. But it's a lifetime. That trauma has gripped me for a lifetime. And you know that guy, that coach, his name is Jack Nelson. He's in the International Swimming Hall of Fame. And when you call and ask them about it, they'll say, look, we looked into it. It was her word against her, but it wasn't like that. There were others besides me who spoke up too, but it's a big, good old boys network, the same as the gymnastics coaches was, and he is still in the International Swimming Hall of Fame. So, you know, we're dealing with a societal problem as well as just my little personal problem.
Well, I think you underscore that the fact that when there is silence or people are not believed, that leads to shame, as you write about, and also that anger, that sort of boiling anger that just sort of hovers below the surface.
Yeah, yeah. And I think, you know, shame is such a difficult word to define, isn't it?
It is.
But shame usually comes around to being, it's my fault. You know, you're not ashamed about somebody else. You're usually ashamed because something internal is saying, I've done something wrong. You know, I'm not the person you can admire. And this, my coach, who, you know, at first knowing me, thought I was going to be a great champion, and not just as a swimmer, but as a human being. And to turn against me that way and lie about it his whole life as well. And he's dead now, you know. It's been my little cross to bear, you know.
You also have written about the fact that when you were younger, maybe a teenager, maybe even into the early part of your swimming career, that you swam with anger, that anger was a kind of motivator. On the one hand, the water was a place of safety and strength for you, but anger seemed to be driving at least some of your competitive edge.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's only normal when you see a boxer, You know, I don't know if you know the story of Christy Martin, but her movie is just out now. And you can tell she grew up with, you know, abuse in her family and abuse by the trainer of hers and whatnot. And you could tell in the ring, it wasn't just a matter of her being skilled and coming at the other person and putting, she was laying out all of her emotions, all of her anger. And so I think that athletes, they find a place. You know, you talk. I've talked to a lot of athletes who say that was that basketball court. That was my place to run and charge and jump up into the eye and stuff that ball. And I could feel the anger against my stepfather or, you know, whatever the case might be, you know, finally dissipating because I was letting it out. So I think a lot of athletes find solace and let their frustrations, their angers, their disappointments even out as they play.
Was that a motivator as you swam from Cuba to Key
No,
West? No.
no. And especially in my older years when I came back to the dream in my 60s, that wasn't at all. I was feeling much more beatific out there. I wasn't engaged in that anger anymore like that. No.
You speak, I think, for so many people, and I think there's such denial, and again, I'm looking at the clock here, such denial about the amount of sexual abuse that exists for girls and for boys. And it's, you know, even in 2025, people are still shocked to know the number of young people that have had to endure this.
Oh, yeah, it's an epidemic. If I speak in front of 1,200 people, let's say at a conference, I would tell you if people line up because they're maybe selling my book or people are just lined up to get selfies and I want to chat with people and get to know about their lives too, not men, not men. But I would say if I speak in front of 1,200 and 500 come afterwards to hang around and maybe chat with me in the middle, I would say a good 100 of those. So that's a pretty big percentage, isn't it? Will say to me quietly, and they, you know, they don't really have much privacy. There's somebody waiting right behind them to
Right.
speak to me. They will say to me, "The exact same thing happened to me. You know, it was my brother's best friend. It was this." So, you know, I think that we're talking about, as we sit here today, we can imagine in every street corner in Philadelphia, in every suburban neighborhood in Los Angeles, sexual abuse by young people is happening.
Well, we have to take another short break and then we'll get back to our conversation with swimmer Diana Nyad. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives. One moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
You're listening to The Connection here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, again talking with Diana Nyad. We've been talking about her career as a long-distance swimmer, an acclaimed long-distance swimmer, the beauty of the open water when she is swimming out in the ocean. We've been talking a bit about forgiveness, and we're talking why 70s has been the best decade of her life so far. Let me go back to this article that you wrote in the Free Press where you talked about your mother. And your mother had said to you something. This was when she was a bit older, or maybe even had some dementia. She said something that seemed like it was both a statement and a question. And she said, "I was the worst mother in the world, wasn't I?" And you said to her, "No, Mom, you were the best." And you go on to write to say that it wasn't true, but it seemed like the right thing to say at the moment. Take us to that conversation you were having with your mom and what that meant, I guess, to her and to you.
Yeah, well, you know, I tried even in my teenage years to talk to my mom about my coach abusing me. And let's say I've forgiven her. It was a different era. And maybe I hedged around the subject and wasn't straight on, like he did this to me. I was like, I'm feeling uncomfortable. And so she was trying to protect, I think, me and our reputation in this town and whatnot. And she said, "Oh, I'm sure you're exaggerating it, you know." And so I tried again in my 20s to bring it up to her, and she said, "But he's such a great man, you know. He's such a great coach. He's honored. He's the Olympic coach now. I mean, you know." So she never believed me. She never took it in, at least on a superficial level, that would help me speak it out and have she and I be close together. And she didn't just suffer a little dementia. She was full throttle Alzheimer's toward the end. And one day we were sitting in the rose garden and we were holding hands and talking about, you know, how a rose leaf could possibly be made that perfectly and the color of it. And she turned to me with tears welling up and she said, "I was the worst mother in the world, wasn't I?" And I did lie, because what's the point of saying, "Yeah, you know, you didn't support me. You know, she's frail now. She says she's going to die soon." And I said, "Mom, don't ever think that. You were the best mother in the world." And you know what, Marty, I can go back to her reading me Babar in French, you know, when
she was French. Yeah. French born.
Yeah. Yeah. So there, believe me, I love my mother, but just in this one issue of my trauma as a teenager and not being able to be helped, saved by her. I said, "No, Mom, you were the best mother in the world." And, it doesn't matter what she thought about that. She didn't have a response, but we held each other. And I think it was like her way of finally, at the very end, apologizing for not being there for me.
And did that feel good for you? Did that feel
It did.
Healing?
I felt we really came to a place of peace over that. I absolutely forgave her. But then, you know, my regret was that I didn't when I was younger. Look, I lived in New York City for almost 30 years, and I was born in New York, and she first came to the States in New York City. And I didn't have the, I don't know, what would you say? I didn't have the, not just maturity, but I didn't have the loveliness to call her. She was lonely in Florida and say, "Come on up. I'll pay for your ticket. Come up for the weekend. Let's go to a Broadway show. You know, let's go see, go to a French restaurant and talk French all night." I was still angry at her. I was angry at her for not protecting me. And I was angry at her for not being a bolder, fiercer person. I wanted her to go chase her life instead of sitting back saying, you know, meekly. And that was just her. And I was angry at her for it. And years later, I thought, would it have really killed me to be the leader here? And make the friendship happen, you know, it wouldn't have. And I regret it all to this very day.
Well, let me quote something else you write. "I can't go back and erase those early days of confusion and self-loathing. Yet I have since become a person I can truly be proud of." So what are you proud of yourself for, Diana Nyad?
You know, I show up. You know, I do. I just I don't lock my door and not show up for my neighborhood, for my good friends, for my family. And I'd like to say, you know, it sounds pie in the sky, Marty, but I'd say for the world at large. You know, if there's something to be said about plastic pollution in the oceans, I'm not a full-fledged activist. I don't pretend to be, but I speak up. I write about it. I go to marches about it. In this particular political climate, you know, I'm not afraid. You know, or people are going to think I'm outspoken about thinking that, you know, Trump is a danger and an embarrassment. And I'm just horrified to think that this man is leading our great United States of America. So, you know, I have my little word, and I think I just live a bold life every day. I'm engaged. Let's just put it that way. I'm in every area, from the smallest, my best friends, to the biggest, the planet and the future of the planet. I'm engaged.
And as you write, you say the 70s, you're 76, the 70s has been the best decade of your life. I mean, I guess so far, as you say, you haven't reached the 80s or the 90s. But because what, you feel like you can be your authentic self?
Well, you know, no, I think I've been my authentic self for quite a while, for several decades.
Yeah, but I think so.
But I have better perspective. You know, as I was telling you earlier in this interview, is that I think when you're younger, let's take it from the absurd point of view and look at an infant. You know, all they know is their little world. And then you take a 90-year-old and they've seen life. They've been through war, maybe. They've been through death. They've been through births. They've been through, you know, many sunsets and sunrises, and they have a much bigger embracing perspective of this human life we have. I started reading about the cosmos when I was a teenager, and I'm just rereading Carl Sagan's Cosmos now.
Oh, wow.
And so I think now I always appreciated. I was, you know, at 17, I was reading the best I could, you know, sort of astrophysics to the layman. But today I take in every sentence, you know, as to how did this little rock that Carl Sagan called the pale blue dot. How did this little rock get lucky enough after the Big Bang to get thrown into this particular orbit around the sun, just the right distance so that water and nitrogen and carbon could get produced and life came from it? Well, I knew that intellectually, but I'm feeling it much more that we're on a lucky rock right here.
I mean, you clearly have always been outspoken, but is there something about being, again, in your 70s, 60s, and 70s, where it's not like you care less, and I'm speaking in part for myself, what people think about what we think or say, but that somehow it just feels like the moment is right to say what is on your mind because you've earned it.
No, honestly, Marty, I don't think that's me. I don't think I've ever been soft-spoken. I've ever been... afraid to say I'm gay or I'm an atheist, you know, or I'm angry about something, or I think Donald Trump is I can't even think of a strong enough word, but a despicable human being. So I've never been afraid of all that. And it's just that I don't pretend to be that activist, you know, who goes out and has given my life to changing plastic pollution or Donald Trump's presidency. I just feel it and I'll speak it out wherever I am, you know, in my world, however big my or little world my world is, you know.
Do you make room for swimming now? Is that still an important part of your life?
Oh, sure. I'll always swim. You know, swimming has to do with meditation. It has to do with gliding across the surface. It's a beautiful thing to do, is to swim well and swim powerfully. But, you know, it would be like if you and I were here and Roger Federer walked in your studio and we said, hey, Roger, do you still play tennis?
Right.
Well, it would be absurd to what he used to do, you know, if he was playing 8 hours a day, hitting 8,000 backhands down the line. So he might say, yeah, I'll always play tennis. But does that mean he plays two or three doubles matches a week with a gentleman, you know, or friends? Well, so for me, you know, to go for 90 minutes to just like I did in the Mediterranean, just to cruise along and have that feeling and be that swimmer and be that body who can swim, you know, I'll always be that.
You have an organization called Ever Walk. Did you walk across the country?
Yeah, no, we didn't. We took a bus ride across the country to sort of suss it out. And when we left here in Los Angeles, there was nothing. I mean, it was almost dry rock destitution from here all the way to Oklahoma City. So we thought, are we really going to take people walking between here and Vegas and Vegas to Albuquerque and Albuquerque? It wasn't good. So we started doing 120-mile walks, like we walked from Maine up to Boston, up to Maine. We walked from where you are, Philly, down to D.C. We walked from White Rock, Canada, to Seattle. So we've done a number of walks and other types of walks where we walk 10 miles in the morning, work for Habitat for Humanity in the afternoon. So and now we're doing more virtual walks so people can join us from all over. So we didn't walk cross country. I think that's more of a solo activity. Like if Bonnie and I ever wanted to walk cross country, we would. Frankly, I'd rather walk the length of Europe than walk all the way across because of the West. You know, the West is glorious, but it's also there are no people. We like to walk where there are people.
In the movie, Jodie Foster, the Jodie Foster character who plays your manager, says that you have a quote-unquote superiority complex. Was that something made up for the movie, or was that something that was said to you by Bonnie?
You know, I guess is a superiority complex is Sally Ride, may she rest in peace,
yeah,
when she's interviewed about going into space and all the interviewers say, but as a woman, you know, I mean, this, you know, you're too frail, you're too, you know, emotional, you know. So when she says, you know, you don't know what the F you're talking about, why don't you go to astronaut school and get prepared the way I'm prepared? So does she have a superiority complex because she has confidence in her abilities and what she intends to do? No, she's not called that. Like men who are confident, you know, and know what their skills are and say, I'm going to direct that movie. You know, we don't say Martin Scorsese has a superiority complex. He just knows how to work with actors and screenwriters. He knows his craft. And so why shouldn't he say, I'm if not the best, I'm one of the best. You know, so I don't consider that a superiority, you know, complex. I don't.
Did you, I'm assuming you saw the movie. I saw the movie. Were you, how involved were you in the making of the biopic Naiad?
You know, Marty, there's a saying in Hollywood to say that most biopics are made after people are dead, so they can't complain about anything.
Right.
So the filmmakers, the directors, the producers, and the writer, and certainly the actors, I mean, you don't get better than Annette Bening and Jodie Foster. They were all extremely respectful. They read everything, saw everything, met with us constantly. We knew them very well, all of them, Jodie and Annette especially, before shooting started. But and they wanted to be respectful as to who is the real me? Who's the real Bonnie? How did it really work? And they got a lot of it right. They got the soul of it and the spirit of it right in the movie. Well, you saw the movie, and I'd like to say, and if Annette were sitting right next to me, she would tell you that she knew very well that I am, you know, you hate to talk about yourself, but I'm friendlier, I'm more charismatic, shall we say, than the person she was asked to play. They wanted my character to be fierce and unapologetic, and so that there would be a big turn when she finally got to the beach, she could say, you know what? I learned something. I need my team. Well, I knew that all the time. I was almost like a mother to many of the people on my team. I care about their dreams, their dogs, their wives, their husbands. But she was portrayed as someone who could barely knew them. She was just, get out of my way. I'm doing this. I don't care what you think. And yes, is that part of me? But that's not me with my team. And so that's the only part, though. The rest of it, I would say all of the depiction of the why and the how and the people who came together, wasn't a documentary. It's not. It's actors playing a script. But it was quite faithful to our spirit. It was. And I'm very proud of the movie, even though I don't come off as very friendly.
Well, I've looked at a lot of photographs of you, Diana Nyad, on some of those swims, and seeing just your swollen face. I saw those deadly jellyfish, the kind of stings, I guess, that they left on your body. And I'm just trying to, and they're deadly. I mean, we should talk about just how dangerous this was for you to swim between Cuba and Key West.
Well, there are thousands of species of jellyfish. You know, most Americans, especially on the East Coast, know the Portuguese men of war. It's a blue bottle, yeah. And looks like a blue bottle. And but they sting. They're not pleasant. You know, I've had them. I don't like them. But no one in the history of mankind has ever died from a Portuguese man of war sting. Many people die from the box.
Wow.
Our box expert, Dr. Angel Yanagihara, and by the way, there are many species, I'm not sure if it's called species or phyla, but there are many types of box. Not all of them are deadly, but the particular one that is off the north coast of Cuba, and we did our best to try to see it ahead of time. You can't. It's at night. It's an animal, Marty. It's as big as a sugar cube.
Wow.
I would rather, literally, I'd rather see a shark as big as this office face to face and have a chance to maybe take a knuckle and punch it in the face or, you know, deal with it somehow than that little invisible box jellyfish. Because when those tentacles whip to your skin, they take their harpoons and they inject their poison, their venom, into your central nervous system. And I'm so lucky I got through that night. I don't think it's hyperbole. The doctor said it. Angel said it. Bonnie said it. I should have died that night.
Wow. Wow. We're almost out of time here, but I'm thinking when you stumbled onto the beach, and I'm sure you've relived this so many times, just what was that feeling? What was that experience for you?
You know, two things happened. One was, believe it or not, and I still, my memories when they flood back of it, like we just had the anniversary on Labor Day just a short time ago, the 12th yeah. anniversary. So I don't get flooded with, shall we say, the triumphant ego part of it. I don't remember, oh, look at the thousands of people screaming and low, and it was all, I did it, you know. I don't remember that. What I remember is waking up how many countless times at 2 a.m. because we're going to start a big, tough 14-hour training swim at 4 a.m. and not giving up, not saying, Bonnie, couldn't we maybe just sleep in this one day? You know, it's our schedule. Nobody's telling us we need to do this. Let's blow it off. Never. We got up, and if we did 13 hours and 58 minutes that day, Bonnie knows me. She'll blow the whistle and say, I'm sorry, you got two more minutes. Go out and come back. So I remembered the commitment. That's what I remember.
Well, we've got to leave it there. Diana Nyad, thank you so much for joining us today on The Connection. And
my
congratulations
pleasure.
On all the things that you have done in your life. And thank you for joining us today on The Connection as well, which airs Friday and Sunday at noon right here on WHYY in Philadelphia. You can download a podcast of the show wherever you get your podcasts. Al Banks, the engineer for today's edition of the show, and it's produced by Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Thank you so much for joining us.